It goes on and on, and this is an American phenomenon. This is an American phenomenon. This is an American phenomenon. I sit next to her. I just want to tell her.
Hello. All the best for her. Welcome to Two Independents. I'm John Updike.
And I'm Sarah Lyons.
Sarah, it's been 7 months since our last podcast.
But we are back by popular demand.
We are alive and we are back.
And thanks to Becca Whittem,
who basically, like, poked a stick into the slumbering bear that was Two Independents podcast and revived us from our hibernation with the following email. So let's jump right into it, Sarah.
Okay.
Hi, guys. How are you? Happy New Year. This is an email, as you mentioned, from Becca Whittem, one of our listeners in Brooklyn, New York. I heard news yesterday that has me pretty upset, and then I started wondering what you two would have to say about it. And I remembered that I haven't heard a podcast from you in quite a while. The reason you haven't is because we haven't recorded one in 7 months.
I just like to get that in.
I like to share with the world my basic laziness and lack of initiative. So, I don't know if you're taking questions, but I'm sending this one in, and maybe you'll let me know what you think either way. The news is about the death of Aaron Swartz. It's all over the internet, but this was the first thing I read, and it seems decent. I didn't know this guy personally. I didn't even know his name before he died. But I went to MIT, which was involved in some way in this case. He was prosecuted for. And so I know something about the culture there being generally very supportive of the kind of thing he did as a technical creative prank. And I know a little bit about some of the kinds of backlash the New York City Independence Party folks have gotten over the years. And I recently read this article about Occupy Wall Street being shut down. And I remember a few years ago going to this art exhibit at MoMA, I think, that was about Guantanamo Bay. And I remember thinking, why didn't I do more about this? But then I haven't done more, really, and I just feel a mixture of guilt, fear, hopelessness, etc. So what's my question here? I said I was writing with a question. How do you guys think about these issues of backlash, violent repression, etc.? It's a great question.
Yes, thank you, Becca, for thinking of us.
So what do you think? What do you think about issues of violent repression, backlash?
Well, one thing I'm wondering is that she characterized the MIT... was he a current student or
no.
Former student?
He was actually not... He was a Harvard student. Former Harvard student.
Accessing MIT's...
Right. What he did
was intellectual database or something.
Yeah, he snuck a laptop into MIT... and got into their wireless network and downloaded a whole bunch of documents and then snuck back into MIT and got the laptop and left. And the U.S. government went after him.
Yeah, okay. So she characterized it as a prank. But I don't know that he was a prankster or meant it as a prank. That's one. So I just have a question about that. And
I think what she's referring to, and I don't say this as an expert, but I think there is a culture around the kind of super literate, higher education, super smart, techno-savvy guys who basically, the way they make their reputation, the way they establish their bona fides is by basically breaking into things, showing deficiencies in security, you know, they kind of, and I think that gets, usually what they get is a slap on the wrist, and they get, oh, you know, you shouldn't have broken into the Harvard University's blah, 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 but we're going to suspend you for 3 months, but really, it's part of your education, because if you could hack into this, then you can, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I think there is, and there has been, a culture of leniency around people that do that kind of stuff, but that completely changed with WikiLeaks, the whole WikiLeaks thing. They, you know, it seems like there's not the same environment anymore.
Uh-huh.
And again, I say that as an outsider.
Uh-huh.
I'm not part of that world. But what were you, when you said you're not sure he meant it as a prank, like what do you think?
Well, I was thinking of him as an activist. The form of his democracy activism is to democratize access to information.
Right.
And he was very serious and passionate about that, from what I can tell.
Yeah.
Those were the beginnings of my thoughts about it.
Yeah. I saw a video of Aaron Swartz.
Uh-huh.
And was very, you know, and then you read he committed suicide at the age of 26, and you're watching this video of this, you know, just very precocious, bright, thoughtful kid. And it's, you know, it's very upsetting.
Yeah.
I think that the thing it made me think about in Becca's question of, like, what do you think about, because the government went after this guy.
Uh-huh.
Like, they went after him for what, you know, could be, I'm not saying this is true, but could be characterized as a pretty harmless prank, or not even prank, just thing, just accessing documents, that many of which were in the public domain anyway.
Uh-huh.
But the thing it made me think about was the ways in which our society, our culture, there is so much space and for technological advancement. It just seems breakneck.
Uh-huh.
Like just the kind of the speed and the energy and the resources put into breaking down the barriers for communication.
So what about that?
Well, and then this is a messed up, it's confusing thought. It's more like that, so that people then get into trouble that they can't handle. I just think sometimes our technical capacity outpaces what we can handle as a species and also individually. And it just, you know, I don't know.
Well, let me pick up on something that you mentioned to me earlier, which was you said you thought that Aaron had picked the wrong fight in the wrong century. So maybe you could, do you still think that?
Oh, yeah.
You thought that 24 hours ago.
I did.
What do you mean? And
well, the wrong fight in that, this is just me personally. I think that the notion that breaking, that democratizing information, breaking down the barriers, making sure the internet is not censored, making sure that people have access to information, I certainly favor that. I just don't think it's a cutting edge fight. I just think that what's the evidence that people having more information will somehow prevent the rich and powerful from doing whatever they want? Like, I think it's based on this very modernistic premise, which is that if you can, and Schwartz talked about himself this way, as a whistleblower. I just am not compelled by whistleblowing, by the notion of, you know, there's people that are doing things, they want to keep it secret. If we can simply uncover it and expose it to the light of day, that will, by default, improve things. And I just don't know what the evidence is for that. Again, I'm not in favor of media suppression. I'm not in favor of internet censorship.
Well, it's kind of a funny thought, because you're a developmentalist, and I know you believe in democracy, and I think you would agree that democracy should be, you know, part of every aspect of our lives, not just relative to the electoral arena. People should have the right to love who they want,
yeah,
eat what they want.
Sure.
Travel freely, you know, without restrictions to this or that country.
Yeah.
And all of that. And yet, when it comes to this, what you're saying about the wrong fight in the wrong century, you're saying relative to information, access to, in his case, I don't know what he was trying to share from MIT. So what do you think about that? Why?
I keep thinking about the issue of power, because I, again, this is just my opinion. I think that we live in a world in which the vast majority of the people on this earth have no power. They have no power at all. They live in situations and environments and capacities in which their options are so limited and so curtailed that I frankly think that the notion that if you simply give those people access to information, that that will fundamentally transform that powerlessness, I just disagree with that. So to me, democracy is not simply consumer options. It's not simply having more choices in the purchasing of whatever products and services. It's the capacity to shape your life and the life of your community and your family and having options. And that to me has to be built and created. And I sometimes think there's so much energy put into finding new technological ways that a person in New Mexico can talk with a person in China, and I support that. But what about the tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people that live with no prospects? I mean, I don't mean to sound old-fashioned. I don't mean to sound, you know, like a Luddite, like technology's bad. I don't think it's bad at all. I just think it's sometimes it gets put on a pedestal.
Reified,
That I just think democracy is literally, if you have a lot of if there's a lot of options, but you have no power, you have no capacity, then it's frustrating. I think it drives people nuts to live in a world in which they have no power, and yet they're constantly shown that, you know, people can, I don't know, use their cell phones to buy houses or something, or, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's a form of idealism that I think is just a vulnerability of our species, particularly right now, because our technological capacity is just so incredible. It's so incredible. And yet, billions of people have no power in the broadest sense of the word. That's my political speech for the morning, Sarah. Does that resonate with you? Do you disagree with me? Am I being too much? Am I being, like, kind of dogmatic about this? Like, what do you... Give me some nuance here.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm still at my question. If there isn't a silver bullet or golden bullet or whatever color it is, bullet solution to this the power problem that you're identifying, which I accept that that's a problem, then why wouldn't the democratization of information be part of a reorganization of that power dynamic? Why wouldn't it be one of the things and one of the fights that's part of our changing the culture?
Yeah.
So you could say, you know, this is crazy, people raising their fists about, you know, not having access to information. What about people who, you know, are raising, you know, the fact that they're hungry and there's nothing to eat, you know, like that's, it's such a privileged thing to go around saying, you know, we need access to information and blah, blah. But maybe that's what people can do. That's what people are doing.
You're probably right. And I don't mean to insult Aaron or people that are standing up to the kind of censorship and you know, big powerful forces that want to control information. I certainly think that's an important fight. I do. I think the renegadeness with the cavalierness with which that fight is often conducted makes it actually diminishes it.
That makes him vulnerable.
It makes that, I mean,
they're
this
just
guy,
gonna take
they
their
drove
lap.
Him insane and, uh-huh. and he killed himself.
Uh-huh.
I think there's a, ironically, I think they don't take themselves seriously enough. I'm not trying to say, oh, that's not an important issue. I'm saying it is an important issue and you have to take it seriously. You have to take the opponents seriously. These are serious people. They will go after you. They take the ability to shape and control information very seriously. So I think sometimes people like Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks guy, who, again, I'm not an expert on this. I think there's sometimes my experience of how they relate is like, the world is fine. You know, the world in which we live in is fine. But there's this problem, which is the lack of freedom to access information. So I'm just going to fix that problem. And they act like there aren't powerful, corrupt forces in the world that will kill you if you do that.
Uh-huh.
They just, it's a fantasy world.
Well,
so they end up
they're
not...
They're relying very heavily on the foundations of rationality is the...
Yeah.
These facts are known to man. And we live in a democracy, and these facts can therefore be shared. And
right,
kind of in that, I hear what you're saying as though it's in a vacuum.
Right, and I think that from reading the obituary of Aaron Swartz and from hearing people talk about him, no one ever said to him or talked to him and said, look, you need to build allies. You need to create a zone. You need to organize support for this. You can't just go out and rip off documents. You will get your head handed to you. They'll come after you. There's almost like a lack of support. It's just like, yeah, go do your thing. Go try it. And I don't know. I don't mean to be a conservative. I'm certainly not coming from that direction. Like, oh, you need to be, you know, sometimes you do need to take risks and try new things. And, you know, I mean, you can't blame someone. You never know how much they're going to come after you. And I think what Becca's saying about there was this culture of tolerance where people felt like they could get away with stuff. And then that changed. And that's sometimes you learn the hard way.
So she also asks about our experience in blowback.
Yeah. In the independent movement.
In the independent movement.
Yeah.
And we just in the last couple of months had the experience of a tabloid in New York City attacking the New York City Independence Party.
Right.
In a four-part series that was came from the editorial board of the Daily News. They did a special investigative series on the New York City Independence Party, in which yours truly was featured as a bigwig.
Yeah, and my biggest problem with that series was that I didn't get my picture in the paper. You did. And my
all
ego
I can
was bruised.
All I can
my
say
ego was bruised.
Is wear a green satin dress.
You looked good in that picture, by the way. The pictures they used were really good. You look like an elegant power broker. Well, what'd you tell me what you
well, what do
what
we
you
have to
about
say about this for Becca's sake and enlightenment? How do we? I mean, I guess we laugh about it. That's one way that we deal with it. There was definitely points in that process I was not laughing. I guess on the third day I stopped laughing. On the third day they ran their piece calling for DA level investigations of party
right.
leaders, and including me.
Right.
So then I stopped laughing. It's like, wow. Not sure what else to say.
I mean, here's what I think. I think a couple things. One is, you know, when we're talking about this amongst our staff and our networks of people, that this is an indication that we're stepping on some toes, and that's positive because we want to step on toes. We have picked a fight with the political establishment in New York City and in Washington. And in case you didn't know that, those are powerful establishments that do not take well to having their toes stepped on. I also think that part of what you see is when, like, we know how to pick fights in ways that are smart and don't leave us vulnerable. And the networks that we have, the votes that we've gotten, the grassroots organization that we've built, the allies and partners and coalition partners and friends and people we do business with are all part of being able to handle this in a way that puts us in a position to use the attacks to go forward. That's how I think about it. And I know that might sound like a rationalization, but I really think that.
I think I disagree slightly, because the way that you just said it makes it sound like we pick fights that aren't, that don't make us vulnerable, and I don't think that's what we do. I think that we, you know, are on this road to change the culture of politics, and it's a long road, and we're very committed to it, and things happen on that road, and fights erupt, and we are vulnerable.
Yeah.
But we also have a process of working that when things like that do happen, that we incorporate them into what we're building with, which I think is trying to describe what I think is the difference between how we're doing activism versus how Aaron was.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is it's completely made up, and someone could argue that, you know, he reached out in the ways that he reached out every time he was attacked, and tried, you know, socialized it and tried to bring in allies and, you know, build relationships off of it. Maybe we're just going at a slower pace. I don't know what else to say.
No, I think you're right. In some ways, it's helpful your kind of counterpoint, because one way to look at, not the only way to look at what we're doing, is we're working to change the political culture, and that involves a lot of activities. But one of the main activities it involves is organizing other political forces and players to get involved in that. People that are much bigger and much more powerful than we are. That in some ways that's such a bedrock that our movement, our little movement, has no capacity to make this happen by itself, and we're very grounded in that. That we want to play a role in attracting much broader forces to participate in this activity of changing the culture. And that to me is our method forward. That it's the going alone. Uh-huh. It's the that so when these attacks come down on us, I don't feel alone. I don't feel like we're out on a limb, like we've gone way out and now they're gonna cut the tree branch and we're gonna fall down. I feel very grounded.
I think it's important what you're saying about other forces who are bigger than us, because we go you know, take these fights and attacks to the grassroots.
Yeah.
But also to other forces, coalition partners and other political forces who are bigger than us and more mainstream located.
Yeah.
So we're not just always organizing among a base, but as you say, forces that are more powerful.
Yeah.
I think that actually is, you know, again, just trying to think about Aaron's tactic. I don't know that he, or what his appreciation was, and what kinds of work he did to organize forces that were more powerful than himself. And there may have been, you know, the idea that there is nothing more powerful than masses of people who have, who gain access, not just to information, but gain enough power that there's some kind of tipping point of power where they can demand, and their demands for access to all kinds of things, including information, are then met.
Right.
But I don't know that he thought about forces more powerful than himself.
Yeah.
What would those forces be? Would it be, you know, a partnership with Xerox or...
Academic forces, business, I don't know. I don't know that
or
world.
Or within, you know, the CIA and intelligence gathering communities. And
or the civil liberties community or, you know, I don't know. One thing I did read about him, and I don't know if this is true, but they said that through, you know, he was like a child wunderkind. Like he made significant technological inventions like before he was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, this is a kid who's basically spent his whole life as an innovator. And he was constantly looking for mentors, adult mentors, when he was 15, 18, 20. And that he moved from mentor to mentor and did this thing where he would express his disappointment in his past mentors publicly. Like, this person let me down, this person didn't do that, uh-huh, you know, that uh-huh. kind of thing. And I think, the obituary also said everyone always forgave him because it was part of his charm is that he just didn't censor himself. He just kind of spoke. He gave his disappointment and people didn't feel disappointed in his disappointment.
Uh-huh.
But there's something about that that makes me think that he didn't know how to organize more powerful forces. If your prominent emotional response to other players is disappointment, it's hard to organize them.
Mm-hmm.
Because bigger players tend to be less innovative players, almost by definition. They're not going to be as edgy as you are. They're not going to be mm-hmm. as creative as you are because they're more established.
But they bring other things
to the table. Mm-hmm. So he probably didn't. I mean, again, he was 26. That's part of the tragedy of it. Is like, when I was 26, I was learning how to tie my shoes. You know, I mean, like, I was a freaking idiot. But, you know, you just wish he could have gotten through this fight and maybe learned some things. But again, that's just part of my thinking, too, is like, yeah, we live in a world in which people can learn technological breakthroughs when they're 15. But we don't live in a world where people learn how to exercise power and build with other human beings.
Yeah.
We just don't live in that world. It's not related to us what's really important.
Well, we need to learn that and we need to quickly teach that to many millions of people.
We do. It would transform the world.
Yeah.
If people learned how to appreciate and engage in, you know, creating power together, creating those social dynamics, learning how to exercise power. But I think the verb to learn is not the correct word here. It's not an intellectual activity. If that became an activity that was more prominent in the world, that many more people were engaged in, creating meaning and power, that would be a wonderful world to live in.
Indeed.
All right. Well, Sarah, who do you like in the playoffs, football playoffs?
Who's playing?
San Francisco.
And?
The Atlanta Hawks.
Okay.
The Baltimore Ravens.
Okay.
And the New England Patriots.
San Francisco.
Okay. On the NFL, on the NFC side. Who on the AFC side?
And who's playing?
Patriots and the Ravens.
Where are the Ravens from?
Baltimore.
I'll go with Baltimore.
All right, so Baltimore and San Francisco. This is coming directly from the voice of our expert, sports picker. I personally am going with New England and the 49ers.
Okay. Well, that's a safe bet.
The Atlanta Hawks had one of the best records in the NFL this year, and they're an underrated team, and there's a lot of people saying this is their year. But I'm thinking this is Tom Brady's year. They're playing on all cylinders, and I think they're going to win the Super Bowl by 18 points. That's my prediction right here. You heard it first.
Okay.
Hey, one last thing before we go. I'm going to golf camp in March.
No kidding.
I'm going to Florida for 5 days to a PGA golf course with some friends to play and learn golf.
How fantastic.
Yeah, like you 4 hour lesson, then you play 18 holes 5 days in a row. Like serious golf
You're
camp.
You're going to come back sore. Are you going to work out before so your back is nice and in shape and your shoulders and...
No, I think I'm just gonna throw myself into it and come out of it completely damaged.
You're gonna
my nerves frayed. No, I'm gonna
pull a muscle on the first day if you do that.
I'm gonna definitely hit balls before I go down there. I'm also reading a great, great golf book right now, which I recommend to everyone, even people who aren't into golf. It's Golf by Bobby Jones, or Bobby Jones on Golf.
Okay.
And it's a series of his newspaper articles from the 20s and 30s.
Uh-huh.
on golf, the golf swing, the golf this. And he just writes very beautifully in a way you're like, wow, I could actually understand that.
It's kind of your Zen thing.
Yeah. I mean, he's just a good writer, and you can, the guy, whatever. But it's a good book if anyone's interested in golf.
Excellent. That's very exciting.
All right. Well, that's it. So now our next podcast will be sometime in like August of 2013. Now we're going to try to do these more regularly, get back in the swing of things. You know, we've had listeners in 22 different countries.
And I think that if we get questions, that will be helpful.
Yes.
So if you're listening, please.
Send us questions. TwoIndependence@gmail.com. That's TwoIndependence@gmail.com. Send us questions about politics, philosophy, sports, dining,
culture,
political attacks. We'll go from there. So, for Two Independents, I'm John Opdyke.
And I'm Sarah Lyons.
Have a great week. Still spitting that raw. Yeah. 365, 24/7. All day, every day. Throwback, baby. What you know about that? Damn.